Gary Timpson, I represent Cody Jansen, the defendant appellant in this case, who is a South Dakota State Highway Patrol trooper. The case that brings us here commenced in the late evening hours, April 14, 2015, on a rural road in Clay County, South Dakota. Trooper Jansen observed a car driving erratically at night, pulled it over. That car was driven by one Troy Rakusek, who failed field sobriety tests at the scene, and Trooper Jansen then placed him under arrest for driving while intoxicated and transported him to the law enforcement center in Vermilion, South Dakota. That's the county seat, and it's co-located with the City of Vermilion Police Department. He pulled into an area known as the Sally Port. I think the court knows what that is. And took Mr. Jansen out of the vehicle, and in the Sally Port when they arrived was Tracy Wusterwald, who was a medical tech who had been summoned and was one of the persons in Vermilion authorized to do blood draws for DWI analysis. She was there, and Mr. Rakusek had consented to a blood draw. That's why the trooper had summoned her there. When they got out of the vehicle, Trooper Jansen observed that Rakusek was compliant, seemed calm, had consented to the blood draw, and so for his personal comfort, released the handcuffs, took him out of the handcuffs. And Mr. Rakusek then said, well, I want to go to the hospital and have the blood drawn, and I don't want her, Ms. Wusterwald, who was visibly 8 months pregnant, standing in the Sally Port, I don't want her to do it. So I'm withdrawing my consent. And Trooper Jansen then says, well, if you're withdrawing your consent, I have to go get a warrant, and you're sitting on this bench. You need to get up off the bench so I can place the handcuffs on you. He didn't want to leave him unrestrained in the room with Ms. Wusterwald. He was concerned for her personal safety. He believed and observed that Rakusek was getting more agitated. He ordered him three times to get up off the bench. All three times, Rakusek failed to comply. So the trooper lifted him up off the bench and was going to turn him around to place the cuffs on him behind his back again. And at that point, he felt that Rakusek stiffened and arched his back and leaned back toward him and was actively resisting at that time. And so he performed a maneuver, took him to the ground, resulting in injuries, but then did handcuff Mr. Rakusek. And I think the district court made a couple of errors here. First of all, the district court kind of tried to analyze this in a frame-by-frame analysis. I realize technically when you're dealing with digitized video, frame-by-frame is kind of an archaic phrase, but and failed to consider the totality of the circumstances as we are instructed by the Supreme Court in earlier decisions of this case. They tried to analyze it. Well, can you see a move? Did you see a move or not? And that ignores the totality of the circumstances. The second failure, I think, is...
However, the movement was... very small.
As could be perceived, perhaps, by viewing the video. I don't disagree with that. But the standard is, what was the reasonable perception of the officer? Was it reasonable for him to believe that move, however slight, was resistance, and it was just to take him to the floor? He wasn't trying to injure him. He just wanted to get him to the floor. That's primarily what law enforcement officers try to do. You get somebody on the ground so you can control them better.
He picked him up off the ground and threw him down.
Well, like I said,
it's not like he just... And he was much bigger man.
He's a bigger man. There's no doubt about that.
Much bigger. It's not like he just folded him to the ground. He picked him up and boom, right?
Well, you know, I guess the video speaks for itself. The other thing I think, and I think it directly speaks to that, is Judge Pearsall spent a lot of time talking about the double chicken wing maneuver. And this is a maneuver not taught by the South Dakota Highway Patrol, and that somehow that's indicative of unconstitutionality. This court, as far back as Cole versus Bone, and I can't remember the date of that decision right now, but I think it was at least in the 1990s, says that internal department standards are not relevant for constitutional analysis. And more recently, matter of fact, just April 2nd of this year, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a kind of similar scenario, affirmed the grant of qualified immunity, reversing the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And that case is Kinsella, if I pronounce that right, Kisela versus Huges, I think, K-I-S-E-L-A-V-H-U-J-E-S. It's a per curiam opinion. That situation, Tucson police officers get a call that there's a woman acting erratically and carrying a knife. They respond to the call, and there's a lady standing in the driveway, but it's not the suspect. Ms. Hughes then comes out of the, or Ms. Hughes is a lady standing in the driveway. The other lady with the knife comes out. She's not brandishing the knife, and she's not threatening the lady or the officers, but she is resisting commands, ignoring commands to drop the knife.
Isn't this a totally different case? I mean, just think about this. This guy is arrested and taken into custody. He's put into the back of a police car, and I don't know of any place in the world where people are not at least patted down, and so we know there are no weapons involved. We know he's unarmed. He's in the back of the police car. Now he's transported to the Sallyport. So what you know you've got is a person who's, you know, much lighter, much smaller, and is intoxicated, and you've got a much larger officer. You know he's not armed, and that doesn't seem at all like somebody brandishing a knife or holding a knife.
No, but I think the similarity is this, that the woman in the Casella case says she did not feel threatened at all and was not being obviously threatened, but nonetheless, an officer drew his revolver and shot her four times. And the U.S. Supreme Court found that was qualified immunity, that his concern, the officer's perception, that he was concerned for the safety of a woman in the proximity was sufficient for qualified immunity. And that's why I think it's applicable here.
But in this case, the nurse in the video is already starting to back away. She looks quite surprised at what's going on, but she's moving away, and the officer's got physical contact with the defendant.
He has physical contact, but he has to leave the room to do the warrant application, and so he wants him cuffed because, yeah, the guy's not very big, but this woman's 8 months pregnant, and she's backing away. And like Casella, the Supreme Court just decided, even though the lady in proximity to the knife-holding woman says she herself didn't feel threatened, the Supreme Court said the officer's perception that she might be in danger was sufficient for qualified immunity.
But it has to be reasonable.
I think it does, and I think it's reasonable for an officer.
She was a good 10 feet away.
Yeah, but if you have somebody unrestrained, left alone, and a pregnant woman is particularly vulnerable.
I understand the desire to get him handcuffed, but I think the question is he reasonably protecting her when he feels this slight bump back, and he's much, much larger than the plaintiff, to use the amount of force that he used? I think that's really the question.
Well, I think it is the question, Your Honor, but the thing is, he was attempting to get Mr. Rakusik handcuffed, and his perception was that he was resisting, and to overcome that resistance, to cuff him, and thus effect the protection of the danger or potential danger that he perceived. You know, since Mullinex versus Luna, every one of the Supreme Court cases has changed the standard from a reasonable officer to every officer. In Casella, they said that it must be as clearly established that every officer would realize his action was unlawful. And in Mullinex, a 2015 case said a clearly established right is one that is sufficiently clear that every, my emphasis, reasonable official would have understood that what he is doing violates that right. And you'd have to say every single officer, when he feels somebody's resisting, would know that essentially no other officer would have taken this action. And I think I think that's contrary, I think, to what the Supreme Court is telling us. It's a very high bar, and I think the officer, you know, the disparity in size, you can't really control that. You don't get to choose who you arrest, nor by whom you're arrested. And, you know, you use sufficient force to effect the object, which in this case was to cuff him so that he ended what he perceived to be at least a potential threat to Ms. Wusterwald so that he could go execute the warrant after Mr. Rakusik's withdrawal of consent to the blood test. And so I just don't think you can say that every officer would have seen that this was unreasonable. In the light of the existing law, Mullinex tells us that, and that was a 15 case, and there are others earlier. So I'll save my time for rebuttal unless the court has further questions.
Mr. Storms?
Good morning, Your Honors. Jeffrey Storms for the plaintiff.
I will start by saying I was actually reading the Akersbach case early this morning for the proposition that a video of the incident can create a genuine issue of material fact. So ironic that that came up earlier. I do want to talk about kind of the broader kind of question that you pose in the preceding argument about we're now seeing plaintiffs citing Brown and citing Shannon, in some cases with a lack of success. And I think what we're seeing is we're seeing defendants trying to push the bounds of some of these decisions. Because the proposition, to your point earlier, Your Honor, that force is least justified against nonviolent misdemeanants who are not fleeing, who are not actively resisting, and are not posing a threat to officers, has not been critiqued by the Supreme Court at all.
If been tasered, there'd be no question, probably in either mode, military or stunned, there'd be no question that he'd be entitled to qualified immunity even if there was a fall and injury, right? Rosser.
So
if you start there, I mean, he's sufficiently resistant that force and not just a minimus force can be used to control him so that he can be cuffed. Now, why do we draw the line, taser's okay, but this takedown was not?
When it comes to takedowns, we go back to the proposition under Chambers that we are allowed to look at the extent of the injury because it informs us as to the degree of force used. Taser usage, either in a drive stun or in a discharge mode, is not likely to cause the types of injuries that we've seen in Montoya that we see here in this case with missing two teeth. And I think that's important for takedown cases because takedowns can occur in a variety of different manners, some of which are impermissible. And the South Dakota District Court by no means said there was a violation of policy, therefore there was an unconstitutional act. That's certainly not the case. But it does inform us, you know, what the Cole case says is that just because you violate policy doesn't necessarily mean you've violated the Constitution. And so here we're looking at an impermissible act where the Graham factors do weigh in favor of de minimis force. More than de minimis force, which was obviously used here as reflected in the video, resulted in a substantial injury. And our case law under Brown, Shannon, Copeland, Montoya, and Small all tell us that this is the type of situation where qualified immunity is not warranted. It's very different than cases like Ehlers and Vesters. The Blazek opinion, I believe, also, I've argued this before Judge Gruner before, I believe that his dissent was the proper opinion there. But as I read the majority in that opinion, what you can only understand from it is that there was a higher level of threat. And in this case, there is no threat that is significant and objectively reasonable.
But your client was being noncompliant, wasn't he?
Under the district court's rulings, as they credited the evidence, we admitted that he did not stand for handcuffing, which is some sort of de minimis or inconsequential resistance. Passive. And everyone disagrees on what that term might be properly. But it's that. The type of resistance that we look at under Roarboro and say just because you engage in some passive resistance doesn't create sort of this talisman that allows all force. And so although my client, and we admit, engaged in a certain level of passive resistance, and that does not by any means entitle the officer to qualified immunity under Roarboro, the force still needs to be reasonable. And as the video shows, objectively, if there is any physical resistance at all, it's so minimal that it's not even noticeable on the video. The video could easily be interpreted by a jury as a lack of physical resistance by Mr. Rakusek. And the court credited Mr. Rakusik's testimony that there was no specific warning before the slam, and that was a decision that the court made in accordance with the summary judgment standard. What's also important to note is that, as I walk through the timeline, of the video, Mr. Jansen puts Rakusik in the double chicken wing at 12:55, and he's still with him in that position from 12:55:00 to 12:55:37. So for 37 seconds, they're still. And what's interesting about that is there is a gap in the video from 12:55:17 to 12:55:36. So a 19-second gap. And how that's been described by affidavit by Mr. Jansen's department is that the video stops moving for inactivity. So we know he's engaging in no active resistance at that point that's being captured by video. Then Mr. Jansen puts Mr. Rakusik up against the wall and directs his forehead against the wall. And Officer Jansen admits that he had complete control over Mr. Rakusik the entire time that his head was against the wall. And as the district court noted, when Mr. Jansen commenced the slam, Mr. Rakusik's head was still against the wall. So he had this individual in complete control. He wasn't a threat. And he uses this extreme amount of force that fortunately it resulted in lost teeth. That level of force easily could become deadly force in that situation. And that's why the South Dakota, his department, critiqued him for it. The state critiqued him for it because his force was unreasonable. They didn't say you used a double chicken wing and as a result your conduct was improper. They actually walked through really a Graham analysis.
State court then under state law. That does not control constitutionality.
And I agree. I couldn't agree more, Your Honor, that that does not control constitutionality at all. But I thought that their opinion was particularly well-reasoned in terms of a constitutional sense where they walk through how unreasonable his conduct was. He wasn't posing a threat. He was much larger. He used significant force to slam him to the ground. He used an impermissible technique. So certainly that should be relevant to the consideration. And only because of that reasoning with respect to the unreasonableness of it do I think it's really useful in the court's analysis at that point.
It does appear to be a slight pushback right before the takedown, doesn't it?
Well, I'm a former wrestler, so how I view the mechanics may be a little different, but if I can step out from the podium, as I saw it, I saw Officer Jansen kind of move his buttocks back, which you would do if you were preparing to shift your hips. I do not see Mr. Rakusik jam him to make him do that. I believe that Officer or Trooper Jansen is preparing to slam him on the head, and that's why he's loaded. He's loaded up his weight, he's loaded up his hips, and he's throwing him. If I were going to suplex someone in a freestyle or Greco-Roman wrestling match, that's exactly what I would do. I would get my hips back, I'd load him up, and I would throw them, and that's exactly what he did. And to do so in these circumstances was entirely unreasonable. And we believe that it's well controlled under a number of the clearly established precedents that we cited earlier. And for that reason, we ask that the court affirm. Thank you.
Well, here we have it again, is somebody's perception of that video that says, I don't think it shows this, or I think it shows that. The standard is, would every officer have been mistaken in believing that there was resistance and having concern for a pregnant woman in the room, taking this guy to the ground to cuff him after he had refused three times to stand up from the bench and so forth. You know, Mr. Storm talks about defendants using Brown and other cases to try to, quote, push the bounds. The Supreme Court of the United States is pushing the bounds. I believe Judge Loken earlier referred to it as a scolding. But we've got the Casella case, which I've heard, D.C. versus Wesby, which was decided in January of this year, and that's famously called the Peaches case, and that had to do with whether or not somebody was authorized to use a house for partying and other things of that nature. In 2015, Mullenix versus Luna, and Mullinex said specifically, reasonableness of force is a pure question of law, not a factual issue. And that was the first case, I believe, where they went from a reasonable officer to every officer realizing that the conduct was illegal. And there must be a precedent so clearly defined that every officer would know that. We don't see that kind of precedent in this case, where somebody is resisting being handcuffed, or at least the officer reasonably believes that resistance is occurring, and the guy is injured in a subsequent takedown. I haven't seen in the district court's opinion, nor in Mr. Akusik's brief, any case that shows that clear precision that the Supreme Court, since 2015 at least, and maybe even earlier, has required. What the standard is, would every officer have known that reacting to a perceived resistance of being cuffed and believing that there's a potential danger to a nearby pregnant woman be excessive in the takedown? The Supreme Court of the United States, I think, says you have to have almost that precision. The cases continually say we don't require a case exactly on point, but in fact they seem to. But the district court opinion and the opposing brief don't have any cases that are even, I think, you know, close to this factual scenario that would make every officer, much less Trooper Jansen, aware that his conduct was would be unconstitutional use of force. And I will conclude unless the court has further questions.
Very good. I think counsel will thoroughly brief this and cover it.
I thank the court for its time.
This morning, our argument's been helpful, and we'll take it under advisement.
Thank you, Your Honors.